The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
Hey, what happened?
You're going to say, please, please, Mr. President, we can't stand it anymore. We don't want to keep winning. And I'm going to say, I don't care. We're going to make America great again.
I am so, so thrilled and so grateful to all of my supporters out there.
We are the only campaign that has beaten and can beat Donald Trump.
What happened?
What's up?
We lost yesterday in Nevada by 5 points. A month ago, we were 25 points behind. If you look at the national polls, those numbers are tightening up.
I have a 15-year record of turning conservative ideas into conservative policy. I didn't become a conservative 2 years ago.
The people of Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina have spoken, and I really respect their decision. So tonight, I am suspending my campaign. Yeah, yeah.
Now we're through the looking glass here, people.
We won with everything.
White is black, and black is white.
Tall people, short people, fat people, skinny people, just won.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. The show must go on. The two parties will crisscross this week. Democrats vote in South Carolina on Saturday, Republicans tomorrow in Nevada. But instead of the politics, today we want to focus on how one candidate has essentially made 2016 his personal performance space.
I am going to be the greatest president that God ever created.
America cannot take its eyes off of Donald Trump. And even when we're all watching, his shifting answers and half-truths never seem to catch up with him the way they would with another candidate. Listen to Trump here talking about the Iraq War at the Republican debate in South Carolina last week. He's very explicitly saying that George W. Bush lied to get us into the war.
You do whatever you want. You call it whatever you want. I want to tell you, they lied.
Okay.
They said there were weapons of mass destruction. There were none. And they knew there were none. There were no weapons of mass destruction.
Okay. All right.
Just a few days later at a CNN town hall, challenged on the notion that George Bush lied to get us into Iraq, listen to what Trump had to say.
I'm not talking about lying. I'm not talking about not lying. Nobody really knows why we went into Iraq.
And that right there is the Donald Trump way, brushing off previous answers, staying one step ahead of candidates or reporters, using his own standard of truthfulness. These skills are not new to Donald Trump. Many of them might seem like the reality star he was on The Apprentice for more than 10 years. The reality show star, yes, but Trump used many of the same tactics in business throughout his career, managing the media message, managing rivals, and making deals. So today we want to take a couple of minutes and look at Trump 2016 through the lens of reality television, but also through the lens of his career in business in the 80s and 90s, the tactics that made him so successful managing the media and managing his rivals. Here with us is Mark Singer, a staff writer for The New Yorker, who first wrote about Donald Trump as a performance artist in 1997, and also Eli Addy. He's a TV writer and producer whose credits include The West Wing. He was also chief speechwriter for Vice President Al Gore. Gentlemen, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi.
Hi.
Mark Singer, let me start with you, because back in this piece in 1997, which holds up remarkably, by the way, after 20 years, you talk about a Donald Trump who uses what you call simulated intimacy with whoever he's talking about, that he never budges from his persona. He stays in character at all times when he's managing people. And I thought, gosh, I can really see that at these rallies. I can see that in the interviews he does today.
Yes. He does that. Simulated intimacy, of course, is what a salesman has to offer. It's not the real thing. It's not real friendship. And but within that simulated intimacy is an underlying fact that the world revolves around Trump. He's not really thinking much about the other person. This is a person who operates out of instinct, of course, far more than out of intellect.
except that it's never not worked for him. It seems to have been a successful strategy in his business dealings, dealings with the press, people like you, even back then.
I think it works to the extent that people don't look carefully. If you look carefully at Trump, as I tried to do originally, you see that there's a great deal of the smoke and mirrors that are involved in maintaining the illusion. Look, all these buildings that have Trump's name on them, those are not owned by Donald Trump. Those are one way or another owned by his moneyed partners, condominium associations, whatever. Trump's great achievement was branding himself with a product, real estate, that no one had ever quite branded that way before. And he has been a master of maintaining a number of illusions about himself. And right now, he's offering the illusion that he actually has something to offer the American people that is real.
That's real, but
in his case, I don't think he's given much thought to governing. I don't know that he's given much thought to what's going on beyond the immediate process of getting elected. He clearly, when you look around, is caught up in a game of his own devising, he thinks, but there's a larger game that it's a part of, and that's the reality distortion that he generates.
Eli Addy, let's look at the world of television, because there is this tendency to interpret Donald Trump just as the reality star he has been for the last 10 years or whatever, somebody who kind of understands the cadence of reality television, the ever-shifting plots, give him something new, keep him talking. Is it as simple as that when we watch Donald Trump on TV?
No, it's not as simple as that. But, you know, it's interesting because in my business, which is developing scripted television, there are now something like, I don't know, 400 or 500 different television shows on the air, on streaming channels, on cable. And Trump came of age as a TV star when all these programming options were exploding. And a word you hear now a lot in scripted television is noisy. What's going to make this character noisy? What's going to make the show noisy? Something like Cookie on the show Empire, you know, who does and says outrageous things and you kind of can't wait to see what she's going to do next. He is the perfect TV star for this era because, you know, he was able to stand out as the star of The Apprentice among those, you know, God knows how many reality TV shows, 400, 600. And that's really what he did, maybe unwittingly, in the Republican race. He had no way of knowing he was going to run against such a giant field of also-rans. So I think some of it is that. Some of it is just knowing how to stand out. But the other thing is, as Mark was saying, it's so untethered to reality. This is a campaign that couldn't – I mean, that's the irony. You know, reality TV is actually very scripted, and teams of writers – they don't always have the title of writers – are trying to figure out, you know, what outrageous, salacious thing, you know, the characters can do next. And that's what Trump does in his campaign. And it's a campaign that you couldn't run if you'd even been a dog catcher for 10 minutes because there's no thought given to the consequences of those promises, the things he says on the stump, you know, what he would actually do if he got elected.
Okay, promises are one thing, Eli Addy, but what about the 180-degree shifts? I mean, I just played for you a minute ago an example of Donald Trump saying George W. Bush lied to get us into Iraq. A couple of days later, he said, well, I don't know about lied, whatever, moved on. No consequences. No other candidate on the Republican or Democratic side could do this.
Politics are so polarized now. I think you could say there really are a number of different realities, right? Take the idea that tax cuts grow the economy, which was rejected as false by every serious economist in America. It's not considered a lie. Every Republican office holder just about still says that. So the question isn't how much you bend the truth, I think. It's how you react when you're caught. And Trump doesn't react. He doesn't admit he's lying. He doesn't apologize. He doesn't retreat from anything he said. So there's no piece of footage of him, like almost every other politician, fumbling, dissembling, trying to explain away a gaffe. In his reality, there really are no gaffes. There are no lies. So as sheer performance, which is what this candidacy is, it's seamless. In some ways, it's perfection. He creates his own reality. And, you know, some people dismiss him as a liar. He is a liar. Look, I think it's performance art. I think he has kind of created a persona, and he's selling it as hard as he can. And you know, outrageousness has worked for him.
One of the problems here, though, Mark Singer, is that there seems to be already a self-defined, predefined basis of the Trump campaign, which is any bad thing a reporter says about him, any fact check, is just the media trying to tear him down, and we're sick of the media too.
Trump has a percentage of a percentage, a fraction. He doesn't have a majority of American voters on his side. So while he's getting away with that now, there's no guarantee that he's going to be able to persuade 50% of American voters that what he's saying, that he cannot be held to account for what he says.
Well, we spent a lot of time sort of sneering, I think, at the way Donald Trump conducts himself in the campaign. But Mark Singer, he is the Republican frontrunner. He's probably going to be the nominee at this point. You're here arguing that it's only a fraction of voters who've signed on to this, and that when it gets really real, he's not going to be able to keep the carnival going?
I think that he's going to have to answer questions in a way that he has not had to answer them previously. We'll see. So there is so much contempt for the press, and Trump is able to press that hating the press button inside people with success. It doesn't help that Hillary Clinton distorts a lot. I think that that is what's another issue. If they create a false equivalency about lying, then maybe he won't be held to account the way he needs to be. But if she could make fewer unforced errors, assuming she's going to be the nominee, I do assume that, by the way. I could be wrong, but I think that it's going to be very difficult for the press to make the truth stick. Right now, the truth isn't hurting Donald Trump.
Eli Addy says that Donald Trump wants to win but doesn't necessarily want to be president. The Donald Trump that you know, Mark Singer, do you agree with that?
I think he's given very little thought to being president other than, yes, it would be nice to win. I don't think he has a clue how to govern, and I don't think it's was in his mind when he first got into this, and he has not given any practical indication that he cares about governing as much as he cares about ruling.
Reality television and the reality of the modern political campaign. Donald Trump sits atop the Republican field, winning 2 for 3 with a big win in South Carolina Saturday. Mark Singer, staff writer for The New Yorker, and Eli Addy, TV writer and producer, and chief speechwriter for Vice President Al Gore. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There are more than 2.5 million veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, and the majority of them, 85%, receive honorable discharges when they left the service. But 300,000 have been forced out of the military on discharges considered less than honorable, and that means reduced benefits or no benefits at all. Iraq War veteran and Army Sergeant Christopher Goldsmith is one of them. He was written up in 2007 for missing his flight to Baghdad for his second deployment and forced out of the military with a less than honorable discharge. Why was Goldsmith not on that plane? It's because he was in the hospital after attempting suicide the very night before. Now Goldsmith has spent the past 8 years trying to get Congress to recognize that post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, was the cause of that hospitalization, and that he's not alone, that PTSD is often the source of the behavior that gets vets pushed out in the first place. Christopher Goldsmith joins me now in the studio. Christopher, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
What happened in your case specifically? I just gave the thumbnail.
So I deployed to Iraq in 2005 as a forward observer at the age of 19 with the 3rd Infantry Division. You know, I thought I was prepared for war. I wanted nothing more than to be in the military my entire life from the time that I was a little kid. However, my job ended up being basically the photo documentarian and intelligence collector of my platoon throughout daily patrols. And what those duties actually ended up being is photographing mass graves, taking pictures of dead Iraqi police that we may have had a relationship with, dead Iraqi children. It was something that I wasn't prepared to deal with. And even when I got home, PTSD was little more than just an acronym to me. I didn't understand what it meant. I didn't understand the way that it would haunt me for years and possibly for the rest of my life.
So you missed your flight. You're not allowed to do that. Bad behavior. You got discharged. But then when you went back to the Army to say, no, wait, I missed my flight because of a combat-related mental illness, they said what?
Yeah, so, well, the Army knew why I missed my flight. When I survived my suicide attempt, it was on Fort Stewart, Georgia. I was found by military police. My best friend and roommate at the time, Steve Atchison, you know, he's the one who saved my life, and he was there to witness, you know, my downfall. I struggled for a year and a half getting almost no help at all from the Army when I was asking for it desperately. that suicide attempt was something that they saw coming, they could have prevented, and they took no actions. Even when I told an Army psychiatrist that I was thinking about suicide, she told me that I had three choices. I could either, one, I could suck it up, be a man, and I can deploy. I can, two, I can go AWOL and live like a convicted felon for the rest of my life. Or three, I could give up and commit suicide. I mean, those were the suggestions that an Army psychologist offered me when I told her how I was feeling after struggling for so long with nightmares from Iraq.
But Chris, we're told all the time now, maybe it's true now, mm-hmm. and wasn't true at the time that you experienced this horrible episode, that the Army has vastly improved, not only in its identification of mm-hmm. PTSD, but that the culture has improved, that officers now appreciate it as an illness. It's not a question of a soldier not being a good soldier or mm-hmm. not being a man or whatever, that those things have really started to change. Is that true? And it was just too late for you in your experience?
Yeah, the Army has changed. The Army has evolved, and I think the culture has improved greatly. PTSD in 2007 was little more than an acronym to myself and a lot of other soldiers. Today, there is mandated screening for anyone who's being separated from misconduct for PTSD and TBI. In 2007, that screening didn't exist. Now, the thing is that there have been laws passed that have intended to improve this situation, to stop sick soldiers from getting punished. But in 2009, the law that mandated that PTSD screening, the military has been complying with it but not acting in the spirit of the law. NPR recently reported that 22,000 veterans since 2009 have been discharged after being positively screened for PTSD and TBI with misconduct discharges without benefits. I mean, I think it's damn near criminal that you could take a person, send them to war, they come home sick, and then you don't even provide them health care once they get home.
So if there's been an acknowledgement at the White House and in the military that discharge procedures were unfair, how can it not be retroactive? It seems like there's a major contradiction there.
See, there's a major problem. In about two Veterans Days ago, Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel issued a memorandum that would apply to the Boards of Corrections and Military Records for Vietnam vets who have other than honorable discharges. It would provide them liberal consideration in cases involving PTSD. However, Secretary Hagel's memorandum was too narrow. It doesn't affect my generation at all. So they're finally recognizing these Vietnam vets' PTSD. But today, the discharge review boards, they're still not recognizing PTSD the way that Secretary Hagel intended.
What's the resistance when you talk to a senator or a member of Congress? Is it money? If we pay benefits on too many of you guys, it just gets too expensive? What do they say?
I mean, the sad thing is that the DOD budget is planning for about 13% of our generation to be leaving without benefits. If these sick veterans, and I'm not saying all 13% have PTSD, but if these veterans are medically retired, that comes out of the DOD budget forever. So what the DOD is doing is, as it's downsizing the military, as we wind down from these wars, it's pushing everybody out that it can, because the VA budget is a separate animal, and that's not something that they need to consider.
So next steps, you're fighting against a budget and political juggernaut here. They've already accounted for not paying you guys. You've said that. How do mm-hmm. you change that?
Well, we've got the Fairness for Veterans Act. Congressman Kaufman and Congressman Walz have taken the lead in the House. Senator Peters is pushing it in the Senate. I've been down on the Hill working with other veterans to try to get a commitment from every post-9/11 veteran who's been elected to Congress. And, I mean, we could use all the help in the world. If listeners want to call up to their member of Congress, their senator, I mean, that'd be a tremendous help. And we're working to get every post-9/11 veteran in Congress signed up to be original co-sponsors of this bill, which should be introduced by the end of this week.
Christopher Goldsmith is one of probably tens of thousands of U.S. military personnel sent to war and then denied benefits at home because of the mental consequences of that war. He was a sergeant who served with the Army's 3rd Infantry Division from 2004 until 2007. Today, a student at Columbia University. Christopher Goldsmith, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and politics aren't chaotic just here in the U.S.
I want a better deal for the people of this country, to save them money and to take back control.
Over the weekend, London Mayor Boris Johnson announced that he would break from UK Prime Minister David Cameron and support the growing campaign to take Britain out of the European Union and in the process restore UK sovereignty. As one of Britain's most charismatic politicians, the mayor's decision is going to have tremendous influence over how the public votes in a referendum on the topic in June. John Sopel is the BBC North America correspondent, and he joins me now. Hi, John.
Hello, Todd.
Why such a debate now in the UK over membership in the EU? How did you get here?
Britain has always had a very uneasy relationship with the European Union. It likes Europe. We all go to holiday on our holidays to Europe. We don't want to be part of a kind of federation. And it is the same debate that takes place within the United States of America over whether there is too much power in Washington and not enough power to the states. Britain always feels that every time it cedes a bit of power to Brussels, so some of its sovereignty goes. And within the Conservative Party, dating back to Margaret Thatcher, that has been a kind of a neuralgic issue for the Conservative Party. David Cameron, to buy off his what we call Eurosceptics, he said, look, if I win the next general election, which he did last May, I guarantee you we will have a referendum on Britain's membership. So this June, the British people will have a chance to vote yes, we stay in the European Union, no, we go out. Boris Johnson was at school with David Cameron. They were at university together. They were members of the same dining club. They've grown up in the same circles. They've been very close, but they've also been rivals. And yesterday, Boris Johnson, at the last minute, 8 minutes before he made his announcement, sent a text message to David Cameron saying, I'm opposing you.
I'm opposing you. And what does it mean now for June that Boris Johnson, this guy with such a deep gravitational field around him in British politics, is now against his old buddy?
You know, there are very few charismatic politicians left. And you can see that in the USA, where Donald Trump is making hay because, you know, whatever else he's got charisma. And Boris Johnson has a similar amount of blonde hair on top of his head, is as outrageous often as Donald Trump. They're very different in a lot of other ways. But he is one of these people who manages to cut through. He reaches the parts of the populace that ordinary politicians just cannot get near. And that makes him a particularly kind of welcome addition for the people who are campaigning for Britain to go out of the European Union. Huge disappointment, big problem for David Cameron. And so the debate has suddenly got rather exciting because the no campaign, the Brexit, Britain exit campaign, suddenly has a very charismatic figurehead.
And then all of a sudden, that charismatic figurehead, Boris Johnson, is open to charges that his timing, his positioning in this big fight is all for his own political benefit and his own political future.
You've put your finger right on it. And I'm sure that is what the people who support Britain's membership of Europe will be saying. This isn't about Boris Johnson wanting to bring Britain out of the European Union. It's about Boris Johnson wanting to see succeed David Cameron as Prime Minister. And if Britain pulls out, David Cameron would almost certainly have to resign. Who would be standing there saying, well, look at me, I'm ready to take over? It would be Boris Johnson.
And that means that Boris Johnson now has a few months to lead a de facto campaign, perhaps for next Prime Minister. Is it that simple?
It is that simple, because the next Prime Minister is going to be elected by the members of the Conservative Party in Parliament, not by the British people, because David Cameron has vowed that he will go before the next election.
And certainly Boris Johnson now seems to be the de facto leader of the more than 100 Conservatives who are now backing exit from the EU. John Sopel is BBC North America editor. Late last month, a judge ruled that a 130-year-old statue of Robert E. Lee in New Orleans could be taken down. It's one of four Confederate monuments slated for removal in that city. And it's a debate that's playing out all across the country. At Yale University, students are agitating to rename the undergraduate residential house named for prominent U.S. Senator and white supremacist John C. Calhoun. And in Washington, D.C., the beloved Ben's Chili Bowl restaurant has a controversial mural of Bill Cosby on a big wall outside. Renee Romano is professor of history, Africana studies, and comparative American studies at Oberlin College in Ohio. And I talked to her about why we build monuments, why we tear them down, and how these controversies play out in our debate about our own history.
When we put up a monument, we are saying not only that this was our history, but this is the past we choose to celebrate. So what they're saying, I think, when they take down those monuments is that in our contemporary moment, that is not the past that we want to celebrate and legitimate and to put forward as the one for lessons for future generations. And one of the things we can say is that putting up a monument is not only legitimizing a history, it's also about who has access to public space, who has access to full citizenship, to civic equality. Since the 60s, really, there's been a long, hard fight on the part of many African Americans and other racial groups to say our history needs to be represented, but also we need to take down monuments that are monuments to white supremacy, because that degrades us in public space.
So where is that line to you? You know, I think a lot of people, whether they're for it or against it, can understand the logic behind removing a Robert E. Lee statue because of the Civil War, because of slavery. What about, and I know you know where I'm going with this, mm-hmm. Thomas Jefferson, one of the fathers of the country, who, of course, owned slaves for his entire life, who fathered children with a slave?
Right. So when you ask that question, you're really asking to me how we would weigh someone's accomplishments and the great things they did in their life against the other things they have done in their life that we question or we think were really problematic. Right. And one really extreme example that you can say is that if a man has done evil in his lifetime, he should not be complimented in marble, which is something that Charles Sumner said about Chief Justice Taney, who was the justice who came up with the Dred Scott decision in 1857, saying blacks can't be citizens. And I think that's too extreme because none of us are paragons of virtue, right? I can't imagine the person who is so perfect that they have done nothing in their life which could be called into question. So then again, you're coming back to a political conversation about how do we weigh that person's accomplishments against their flaws? And are the flaws such that they simply reflect the flaws of society at the time that they were living? Or did they further and expand injustice in their society? Were they instrumental in pushing programs of oppression? Thomas Jefferson, I think, is someone who I would be somewhat ambivalent about. I think his accomplishments were very large, right, and really important for the country. Woodrow Wilson, I would have less ambivalence about, and that I think some of the things he did really put him outside of and made him a leader in promoting racism and segregation, and that might outweigh some of his accomplishments.
Is the answer then to put up companion monuments of Martin Luther King or Malcolm X, if you like, or is the answer to take down the offensive monuments? You use the term all, and I don't know that there is an all in terms of identifying a national identity that would be acceptable to everyone.
Right. Well, that path is what we've taken right now, that if you go to many places in the South, what you've seen is Black History monuments or monuments to the Civil Rights Movement going up next to monuments for the Confederacy. And I think that is maybe a middle ground, right, to say, but I think it's actually really problematic middle ground, because what we're saying there is we can have two separate histories. You can celebrate what you celebrate, I can celebrate what I celebrate, and we don't need to ever really consider the reckoning and the interactions between these two, right, because they really are interactions, right? If we're putting up a Martin Luther King, he's fighting against the Confederacy. So I would hope that eventually we'd get beyond that, simply putting up competing monuments, to saying we need to sit down and have a conversation about how to move forward and who are the people we can value as a society to create a more unified national identity.
Let's talk about Mount Rushmore for a moment. Maybe it's our most famous national monument. There is one not far away being built by a family. It's been ongoing for years and it's unfinished, a large carving of Crazy Horse. And this is a direct statement by Native Americans on whether or not Mount Rushmore is appropriate.
Yeah, and that Crazy Horse Memorial is fascinating. It starts not long after Mount Rushmore is nearly completed. There is a Native American leader who says, I want the white man to know that the red man has great heroes too. And that becomes his mantra for getting this project started. It has been ongoing since the 1940s. It is not completed. It is not near completed yet. I was there last summer. It's a fascinating site. And one of the things that statue does, carved into the mountain, it is Crazy Horse on a horse, his arms outstretched, with his finger pointed out, and it is supposed to represent that these are my lands where the dead lay buried. So it is a claiming of, we may have been displaced off these lands, but this is our heritage. This is where our dead are buried. These are our lands. It is a indirect opposition to Mount Rushmore.
So what needs to happen here, Professor Romano, do you think? I mean, there are national commissions on monuments. More forethought, more diversity on these panels as we go forward? Or do we need more panels on what to leave up and what to take down?
Well, I think that the construction of monuments is always a part of a political process. And one of the challenges of monuments is that once they're erected, we lose the history of how they came to be, right? We don't know who put them up. We don't know who paid for them. We don't know whose interests they represent. So that process of construction needs to be one where there is a broad community of interests involved. But in terms of taking them down, I think it's really when a monument becomes a flashpoint, when there are people challenging it and saying, this needs to go because this is reprehensible to us, that we need to have a serious conversation about, is keeping this up worth sending a message to a particular group that you're not fully included? I think it behooves us as polities communities to take the complaints seriously and to really ask, why is this so disturbing to this group of people? And is this the message we want to be sending or not? And in 21st century America versus when it might have been erected in 19th century America.
Our identity as Americans, as Northerners, as Southerners, as African Americans, as whites, Native Americans, reflected in the stone monuments, the marble that we erect, and sometimes the marble that we choose to take down. Rene Romano, professor of history at Oberlin College. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
There used to be a huge Christian cross at the apex of Coley Coley Pass near Schofield Barracks, where the Japanese started their attack on Oahu in World War II. Back in the 80s, there was a protest about the cross having to do with the fact that not all who died were Christian, the cross being on federal land and the division of church and state. Eventually, the cross was removed.
Statues and symbols, 8778-MY-TAKE is our number for you to weigh in. From Broadway to television and the big screen, Mike Nichols was a prolific director, one of an elite group of people who've earned an Emmy and a Grammy, an Oscar and a Tony Award, among a lot of others. His 1967 movie, The Graduate, launched Dustin Hoffman's film career. The documentary Becoming Mike Nichols premieres tonight on HBO. It's a tribute to Nichols' career and his legacy, shot interview style over the course of two nights at Broadway's Golden Theater. It's a revealing look at the early life of Mike Nichols, who died just a few months after it was shot. It was directed by his friend, filmmaker Douglas McGrath.
He was a great film director. He was a great director for the theater. But even more winningly and more amazingly, he is a great actor, but specifically an improvisational comic actor.
Can you tell me what was the loved one's name?
Seymour Maslow Freen.
Is that hyphenated?
It was.
This was the most surprising part of the film because I had no idea that he was a young actor. I had no idea he was an improv actor with Elaine May. That was all new to me, hilarious and fascinating.
It's my belief that the best of the rest of his career came out of his skills as an improvisational actor.
But that sense of improvisation didn't just operate in film or on stage, it seems to me. It seems to me it informed his entire career. He tells a story in your film about the first play he ever directed, with just a young blonde guy named Robert Redford.
And I said, look, why don't we try it out and try me out? Why don't we do it in stock? In 5 days. If the play is any good and if I'm any good, we'll find out. And we got up there, and we were running through. It's the first and only run through. And Neil Simon says, listen, this is impossible. This isn't funny at all. We can't open. We can't do this. We cannot do this play. And I did my first grown-up thing of my life. I said, look, they're coming tomorrow anyway. Why don't we see what they think? And they went nuts. Clearly a big hit.
Barefoot in the Park, the first play Mike directed. And what you do in 5 days is you don't have time to work it out in a fancy way. You don't have time to plan all the tiniest little details. What you find is the essence of something.
He tells the story in the film of being 7 years old. He came from Germany fleeing the Holocaust. He had a very improvised childhood.
I guess he did have to learn quickly to think on his feet, so to speak.
I spoke one sentence of English, which was, I don't speak English, please don't kiss me. My mother was in the hospital, which is why she didn't come at that time. She was ill. She'd been ill then and for much of the rest of her life.
Mike and his brother came over on the Bremen. He's 7 years old, and he has to figure out, how do I fit into this new culture? And I think that's where he developed his extraordinary gift of personal observation.
Talk about The Graduate, if you would. I mean, that's the one famous seminal film that I think most people identify with Dustin Hoffman's first film, sort of discovered by Mike Nichols. How did that work?
I love this story. One of the people who really wanted the part was that blonde guy from Playhouse 90, Robert Redford, with whom he worked in Barefoot in the Park. And Redford really wanted to be in it. And Mike said, well, no, it doesn't make sense. And Bob said to him, well, why not? And Mike said, okay, let me just ask you something. What is it like for you when a girl turns you down, when she doesn't want to go out with you? And Redford said, what do you mean?
Right. When does that happen?
And Mike is like, that's my point. You can't be in the movie. This is not about a person like you.
After we had tested a lot of people and seen hundreds of people, I said, I did see a very talented guy. I have no idea if he's right for this. Let's get him out here and let us test him. And he came out, and he was Dustin, and he had the thing that Elizabeth had, and it's very, very rare people who have it, which is what seems to be a deal with the lab, that they get better in the bath overnight.
Mm-hmm.
That what you see on the floor when you're shooting is good, but what you see on the screen next day is quite a lot better.
What Mike liked in Dustin was that he had an alienated quality and an anxious quality. And he was able to convey this kind of panic that Benjamin felt without seemingly doing anything. And one of the things Mike told us that's an essential part of the documentary and is the essential story of The Graduate is the last shot. You can tell that the script meant the movie to end with them having escaped, and it was going to be a big, happy, up ending. And Mike's whole feeling that things have to remain open to surprise and to whatever the moment is. When Dustin and Catherine Ross got to the back of that bus and sat down and turned around and looked at all the people on the bus staring at them, they laughed, which is what they were supposed to do in the script. And in a less great movie, the director would cut there. But in fact, Mike let the camera run and run and run. And so what you see is the smile on both their faces fade, as it would naturally. And then you see, because he's letting them sit there and absorb what's happened, you see on both their faces, Dustin Hoffman's face and Catherine Ross's face, the hugeness of what they've done starts to dawn on them. You can see that they're really thinking about not only what they've done, but what's coming.
You can see they're both saying, what now?
What now?
Terrified.
What have we done? Which is not a commercial question that people like to ask, but it's actually what makes the movie great.
There's a long filmography from Mike Nichols. You have Working Girl, Silkwood, Catch-22. One film that you didn't deal with, that Mike Nichols didn't deal with in your documentary, is Angels in America. I would have loved to hear Mike Nichols talk about how that movie was made, how he used the ensemble cast, and how he approached this famous play to put it on screen.
What I noticed about Mike talking about the later work, and by the later work I mean anything after The Graduate, is he politely answered the questions but seemed to have nothing specific to say. And when I called him one day from the editing room, I said, you know, I'm getting this idea for the shape of the film, and I think it should be your early life. Nichols and May, early Broadway, the first two movies. I said, that seems to be where the bulk of the best material is. He said, I'm going to tell you something. I feel most directors do their best work early. He said, I think I did my best work early. He said, I think The Graduate is my best film. He thought The Odd Couple was the best thing he had done on Broadway possibly ever, but he said, if not, it was the best thing I did for a very, very long time. I think he had a high regard for the other things, but the other things, I think, weren't about discovering the way the original pieces were.
Douglas McGrath, talk about the time when Mike Nichols went to the Playhouse and saw Marlon Brando and Jessica Tandy in Streetcar Named Desire. He says this is a seminal moment. It's hard to imagine it not being a seminal moment if you're into the theater.
He went with a friend of his, a girl from school. So he was, I think, in junior high.
So there we were, 15 or 16, stunned. We sat poleaxed. We didn't go to the bathroom. We didn't move.
Yeah, I bet you did.
For the length of the thing. And we sat silent during the intermissions. We never got over it, either one of us.
Yeah, I bet.
He said he'd never seen anything like it. All these years later, six decades later, he could still remember how Kazan had people moving around in the background that you could barely see, but you would see enough. He remembered details really for 60, 70 years.
Douglas McGrath directs Becoming Mike Nichols. It premieres tonight on HBO. And here's something to take with you today. Want to be an astronaut? The odds are not in your favor. Sorry. More than 18,000 people have applied for just 14 open positions in NASA's latest astronaut training class. That's a new record. NASA will announce its candidates in mid-2017. You have to learn spacewalking and Russian and a lot more, of course. Brush up on your math. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.